And so if you imagine living in a world in which the highest powers on earth deploy technologies with the explicit purpose of improving the human race and improving nature, even if they get it right, that eliminates by and large our ability to live organic, natural lives.
Hi everyone, this is Veronica Kirilenko of the New American Magazine. Transhumanism, or the merger of physical, digital, and biological worlds, is part and parcel of the fourth industrial revolution. It is viewed by its ideologists and enablers not only as a desirable, but as an inevitable trajectory of the evolution of humanity. As one of the most prominent organizations promoting transhumanism, the World Economic Forum advertises it as an opportunity to help everyone to harness converging technologies in order to create an inclusive, human-centered future. What's not to like? Today, I'm speaking with Joe Allen, a transhumanist editor of the War Room Pandemic, with background in science, technology, and theology. Joe is the author of the book entitled Dark Aeon, Transhumanism and the War Against Humanity. Joe, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Veronica, thank you very much. Very glad to be here.
Thank you, Joe. Joe, you emerged as one of the most recognizable and well-researched experts on transhumanism, primarily due to your work with Steve Bannon. Yet transhumanism is not a discipline taught in colleges, at least not yet, even though various facets of this matter have been studied, tested, practiced, and perfected for decades. Please tell me about the developments of your professional interest in transhumanism, and also perhaps observations that triggered your concern about it.
You know, the moment that Steve Bannon asked me to come on the War Room and speak about it was a pivot point. I'd been writing about technology and a bit about transhumanism for The Federalist. He had seen one of my articles about digital immortality and the transhumanist quest to upload the soul, published in The Federalist. He brought me on the next day. He hired me. And it really took, you know, we're talking about something that I had been writing about off and on for probably 10, 12 years. And something that I had known about and was in, you could say, the back of my mind for some 20 years, but the 2.5 years of working with Steve Bannon have been critical to really wrap my head around, what are these people after? What are they talking about? Who are they? How plausible are the scenarios they're putting forward? Those sorts of questions. And so Dark Aeon is the culmination of 2.5 years of just nonstop immersion in the topic, and really it's the religion, which is really the core of what transhumanism is. It is a techno-religion, and also transhumanism. You know, I came to the topic my late teens and read about it quite a bit in my early 20s. At the time, it seemed very implausible. Now, the technologies are catching up to the point that one really does wonder what approximation of those futures will actually come into reality.
Interesting. Joe, in the opening chapter into the Electric Ant Farm, you write, multi-front battles rage on the ground over national sovereignty, corporate predation, sexual and racial identity, environmental degradation, religious virtue, and moral integrity. But the ultimate determinant will be technology. Why technology? Why are you placing it at the pinnacle of the complex processes and conflicts that societies are immersed in?
You know, it's not necessary that that's the case, but given the state of society as it is right now in any advanced country and most developing countries, everything hinges on the digital. I can't really think of any movement in the last 5 years that wasn't fueled, monitored, and manipulated by the digital. When the Arab Spring broke out, what was that? The early teens, that was by and large driven by digital media, social media, and more than likely a little bit of assistance from the intel agencies in the West. The same could be said of the BLM movement, really the entire MAGA movement, the Trump movement. Of course, Trump, his presence on Twitter was critical to all of that. You just go on and on and on. Everything that's happening right now is being fueled by technology and in many ways determined by it. I'll give you one other example, mass immigration. Mass immigration was only made possible by the technologies available in the mid-1900s. Once the floodgates were opened with the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act, suddenly mass immigration was an issue. It wouldn't be an issue were it not for the transportation and communication technologies available at the time. It would simply be impossible. Now, in the era of the digital, in the era of cheap flights, in the era of easy travel, you have the incentive for mass immigration being pushed out via digital media. The techniques in order to get across the border are by and large acquired by way of digital media. So that's just one. Those are two examples of mass social upheavals that aren't really organic. They are, if not entirely driven by the digital, certainly the form that they take and the intensity of the change, the acceleration of the change, is fueled by the digital. So when you look at any of the problems that we have now, that I think are of at least as much concern as any strictly technological issue, racial and gender identity, all these things, they hinge on the people's conception of themselves in the digital environment, their presentation of themselves, their organization of themselves. So really what we're talking about is our society has been saturated with digital culture. And there's really no way to go back. Wherever we go from here, it will be determined by the digital, unless some group of Luddites or independent group of Luddites somehow manage to make it otherwise. In essence, whether it's military conflict, whether it's corporate competition, whether it's the educational model and certain educational models competing against each other, the use of technology is at the forefront of any of these competitions. And as society becomes more and more thoroughly digitally saturated, the technological will be the realm in which these things are decided. And so I think that that's another important concession that I make to the transhumanist idea. Maybe we can stop here. Maybe this is it. We just stop here. We go no further. But if you look at any attempts at conserving social forms, traditions, archaic legal structures, there has never been a time in history in which we just went so far and never further. So I'm quite dubious as to how many people will be able to actually opt out of any of the technologies that are here now, and certainly any of the technologies coming down the pipeline.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP, Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of the New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code N20, END20.
But you just called transhumanism a techno-religion, and elsewhere in your book, you go even further and call it Satanism with the brain chip. First of all, why religion? To many viewers and listeners, such a definition would raise eyebrows, since religion relates to people's conception of divine, which is transcendent and is beyond the usual scope of reason and empirical evidence. And secondly, why do you see it not just as any religion, but as Satanism, as opposition to Judeo-Christianity?
To answer the first question, the basic definition of religion that I'm going with here is simply a worldview that encompasses origins of humankind and the universe itself, a worldview that confronts the problem of evil and the problem of suffering, a worldview that offers some sort of salvation, some sort of way out of that suffering, of that evil. And in many religious traditions, you also have the eschatological element, the element of apocalypse, this belief that we are hurtling towards a moment in which everything will change. Transhumanism, in essence, takes that bare bones religious model, not intentionally, I don't think, it's more of an organic, no pun intended, organic progression, but transhumanism takes that bare bones model and simply inserts materialism, technology, into those vacant slots that are left in the absence of traditional religion. Mm-hmm. So you think about Christianity. Ray Kurzweil, it's been noted by a number of thinkers, Megan O'Giblin probably the best. Ray Kurzweil's concept of the singularity really is, in many ways, a mirror image of Christian theology, but inverted, in which technology is now the highest earthly power, the highest power, in fact, in the universe. So that where did we come from? Evolution. What is the problem of evil? What is the problem of suffering? The problem of evil is the leftover instincts that evolution has conferred to us. The problem of suffering is that we die. What is our salvation? Our salvation comes from neurological manipulation, social manipulation, and various other types of technological manipulation, accelerating to the point that robotics, nanotechnology, and genomics will ultimately create a sort of God on Earth, an artificial intelligence God. And once you hit that singularity, according to this point of view, according to this prophecy, you've basically reached an apocalypse, an unveiling, a moment in which all that is old is swept away and all that is new and meant to be is introduced, is brought in. And so that's just one of many, many versions of this. But the essence of transhumanism is really to return from an atheistic secular humanism to something like the transcendent traditional point of view, except instead of a supernatural force that is drawing the human soul upward and is in some ways justifying or sanctifying the flesh, it is technology doing it. It's just an inversion, all the same forms, but inverted. Now, to the question of Satanism, I'm not being entirely flippant, but I'm being somewhat flippant. You recall, you know, when I say transhumanism is Satanism with a brain chip, there are three elements to that. The first is that the driving force in human evolution in this concept is science and technology and the power that it confers. The second element is the use of infernal imagery, Satan, Lucifer, demons, the use of infernal imagery to represent what are basically materialist forces being harnessed by humankind. And the third is the tendency, the hypocritical tendency among those who are made uncomfortable by these technologies, rightly so, to accuse those who promote radical technology as being evil, of being the evildoers, when in fact they themselves indulge, but by and large, all the technologies at their disposal. This is something that it's not the most friend, it's not really a friend winning opinion, but I would say that the vast majority of those who rail against transhumanism, myself included, are doing so from within a digital ecosystem that is the really the fertile bed from which transhumanism is growing. And I don't really, for instance, if you have imprinted your soul in this digital medium for all time until the lights go out, and your soul is now this one expression of your soul, as I'm doing right now in this sort of ritual, is now being replicated and spread across the networks. It is much more in tune with the spiritual and philosophical orientation of the transhumanist mindset than it is anything like a traditionalist point of view. And so as we drag our heels being pulled into the future, really it's a matter of degrees. And so I would say that we are all living in the devil's lair here.
Why is it intrinsically evil, this technology? Why do you see it like that?
I don't. I don't see it as intrinsically evil. And in fact, one of the elements that, again, that I hit again over and over in the book is that it is very much relative. I do believe in good and evil. I think that anyone who is confronted with someone doing something horrible to a child knows that evil exists. And anyone who has ever seen someone give of themselves wholly to another person or other people knows that good exists. But by and large, down here on Earth, what we call good and evil sometimes is an accurate appraisal of good and evil, actual good and evil. Oftentimes, what we're doing is simply taking our selfish or our communal values and we're saying that's good. And we look to others, other people, or other communities, and we say that's evil or not as good as us. And that lens cannot be ignored. And so with the issue of technology, with the issue of extreme uses of technology, with the issue even of the worship of technology, I think that it is a matter of degrees and it's a matter of orientation. The biggest difference between a traditionalist person living in the modern world right now and a transhumanist or any of the other variants of futurist, posthumanist, accelerationist, so on and so forth, technologist, hardcore technologist, the only real difference or the central difference is the orientation of the soul. In a traditional society, again, we'll stick with Christianity, the soul is directed towards God. God through Jesus. And that is the ultimate destination of each individual. And in a Christian society, that is the ultimate orientation of the society. In any of these more scientistic or technologically based philosophies, and, you know, I would say without a doubt, techno-religions, the orientation is no longer transcending the material. The orientation is towards technology as it exists today. And the orientation ultimately is towards technologies they believe will exist, very much so a matter of faith. And so I don't necessarily think that technologies are neutral. I don't think that what we're doing right now, for instance, is neutral. I think that what that we're doing right now is very, very constrained. And the possibilities of what we're doing right now in imprinting our souls in this digital medium is very constrained and limited to the medium itself. That being said, it's two very different things to say that brain chips are most likely an abomination than to say brain chips will most likely save the human race, if that makes sense.
It does. Joe, in the opening chapter, you warn that the transhumanist elites, which, by the way, you say transcend political spectrum, are, quote, ready to create heaven on earth, even if it looks like hell to most of us. Why such a grim outlook after all the promises, like you said, of transhumanism are nothing short of amazing, with humans 2.0 having supernatural godlike abilities? And why do you believe that most people might end up in a techno hell rather than benefiting from this technological revolution as they did from the previous ones?
I don't necessarily think that we entirely benefited from the previous technological revolutions. Of course, if you've been to a third world country, or even the more primitive parts of developed countries, Obviously, the lack of technology, the lack of sophistication, the lack of medical care, it is a real problem and a drag on the people there. At the same time, it is undeniable to me, anyway, from my observations, that the technological society that we live in right now has stripped so many of the communal bonds and the kind of centeredness of the person, and especially the centeredness of the person in the physical environment and the natural world, that we've given up a lot. So it's a give and take. Whether one is satisfied with what's given, even in the face of having given up so much, that's really a personal question. The book itself is very much polemic. I believe ultimately that these technologies, as they keep progressing, whatever form they do take, represent a descent of the human soul into the material in a fashion that resembles strikingly the mythic motifs in Revelation, the mythic motifs in the Vishnu Purana that describe the Kali Yuga. And it ultimately, as it situates in my own point of view in regard to religion and the soul and God, it seems inevitably tragic to me. Even by the optimistic descriptions of people like, well, just to stick with him, Ray Kurzweil. When I say that it will be a heaven to them and a hell on earth for us, there's a few different meanings. And when I say us, I mean people like me, right? Some people will read the book and be like, oh, that sounds like heaven to me. But what we're talking about is a society that's moving very rapidly towards one in which it's run by algorithms. You're talking about an algocracy, so that increasingly every element of one's life is in some ways influenced or dictated by the algorithms themselves. If you just stay where we're at right now, and it's just a matter of more and more expanded adoption, then it's already hell on earth to someone of my perspective. We're already talking about a society in which much of what made us human, much of the adventure of life, has been given over to the digital, has been given over to the algorithm, has been automated out of us. For people like Ray Kurzweil, they foresee a future in which the human will, he's not a post-humanist, right? He's not the kind of person who believes that human beings will just simply disappear. He just believes that the reflection of the human in the digital will become increasingly relevant as compared to the biological, right? So not unlike your digital persona in a modern society becomes more important than your day-to-day persona out on the street. What he's talking about is with the advanced technologies of artificial intelligence, of brain-computer interfacing, and in his mind, I think he may be a little delusional, but in his mind, that will take place by way of nanotechnology. It could be anyway. It could just simply be your eyeballs and your thumbs as it is right now. But he sees that reflection of the human in the technological is becoming increasingly relevant, that the artificial intelligence will surpass human beings, and that ultimately that fusion of the human with the machine will represent a singularity in which the everything is saturated with the digital, not just everything human, not just everything in our culture, but he believes that through nanotechnology and the expansion of what is known as, and I won't get too esoteric, but computronium, that emanating out of these technological centers, you will have the digital altering everything on the face of the planet, and then moving out into the solar system and the galaxy and the rest of the universe, so on and so forth, that the expansion of the human will be by way of this human-machine merger. It sounds crazy. It sounds like a religious prophecy, because it is. The real thing that bothers me, though, Veronica, is that these prophecies seem to be coming true to some extent. It's an approximation, but it's far beyond where it was 20 years ago. And so if you imagine living in a world in which the highest powers on earth deploy technologies with the explicit purpose of improving the human race and improving nature, even if they get it right, that eliminates by and large our ability to live organic, natural lives. And it will ultimately neutralize the power and validity of religious symbols that direct human life and the human soul to something that is supernatural, something that is beyond this world. Because the power, the real power, if you have a question about what is real, you go to the computer. If you go to the AI God. If you are sick, you go to the machine. If you are unhappy, you go to the machine. If you are lonely, you go to the machine. All of those elements that the spiritual world or the spiritual cultures captured and satisfied are now the increasingly becoming the domain of the technological. You don't have to even follow the transhumanist vision too far to see that these technologies are rapidly becoming the religion or the religious icons of our age, even among Christians, you might still call it God, you might still call it Jesus, but it's still your screen.
Mm-hmm. How far are we on this path to singularity? Some would say, Joe, that you sound way too alarmist and that transhumanist technologies are nowhere close to posing a feasible threats to us or even let alone eradicating humanity.
Yeah, I'm personally very skeptical of the singularity concept in general. I don't know that such a thing is possible. I don't know that such a thing is imminent. In the book, I begin first laying out the general orientation of what transhumanism is, but then move from one world to the next, because there are many different futures that are predicted by transhumanists in many different angles. You know, I begin with Kurzweil because he's a readily recognizable figure. And he also had probably the deepest impact on the transhumanist movement with his prediction of a singularity. Some transhumanists believe that that's going to happen. Other transhumanists believe it's going to be much more gradual. Some transhumanists believe that the real focus of technology should be artificial intelligence. Some transhumanists believe that genetic engineering of the human to increase biological intelligence is actually the best way forward. So, one of the reasons for the length is that I want to explore and turn over these worlds as they relate to the actual technologies in development. So I don't necessarily subscribe to the singularity. I don't necessarily say such a thing is impossible. Who knows what is and isn't possible in the future? What I am absolutely certain of is that some approximation of the trajectory that Ray Kurzweil described in detail in the late 2000s or early 2000s, late 90s, he did pretty good. It's not necessarily the 86% correct score that he's given oftentimes. I've never seen that done. You know, I've never seen that charted out, but it's good enough to alarm me. And so the question then, how far along are we on the path of the singularity? Well, three technologies that he talked about that seem to be catching up. One, the artificial intelligence systems that you see now. So when he was writing The Age of Spiritual Machines in the late 90s, artificial intelligence was just laughable by and large. There were some impressive things in visual recognition, some impressive things in handwriting recognition or optical recognition of text, things like that, a few cognitive tricks. But by and large, AI didn't exist. AI still doesn't exist in its original definition of a machine that thinks like a human. But if you take the human being and you strip out the individual cognitive modules in the brain, those individual modules made digital by way of algorithms, what we now call artificial narrow intelligence, are incredibly impressive and in fact superhuman. So whether it be genetic sequencing or protein modeling or prediction, drug development and the prediction of the effects of a drug, whether it be modeling biological systems or social systems, psychological profiles, social networks, whether it be to modify social networks by way of banning, like targeted banning, completely automated, right? Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, they all use it. You just have AIs crawling over the content, and if it's flagged, it stops it. It either shuts down the account, deletes the post, flags the post, whatever. on up to military technologies, weapon control systems, drone control systems, battlefield surveillance analysis, so on and so forth. None of that really existed in any meaningful form when Kurzweil was writing it. He said it will in the next 2 decades. Well, it does. It's here. The second one is in genetic engineering. CRISPR wasn't even discovered until 2011. Before that, there were various methods to alter a genome, but they were clunky, they were imprecise. CRISPR is far, far more accurate, and it's the primary method now for genetic engineering. Well, it's only been around for about 13 years. Kurzweil didn't predict CRISPR. If he had done that, he would have gotten the Nobel Prize. But he did predict that the uses of this would increase in precision, and that it would be used exactly as it's being used now to alter microbes, to alter human genomes in order to get rid of the various evolutionary leftovers such as cancer, such as Tay-Sachs or whatever, any sort of genetic disorder. There are about 3,000 gene therapy trials underway to permanently alter the genomes and organs of humans. That simply did not exist when he wrote it. But you could say, okay, that's an easy one. I would say that the precision of his predictions were fairly impressive, but also the precision of some of his predictions mean that he would get things just horrifically wrong, such as, say, his prediction that instead of using silicon transistors, we would move to carbon nanotubes by now. None of that's happened. He also believed that by now we would have a fully functional metaverse so that people would spend most of their time or much of their time in virtual reality, other than video gaming and social media as proxies. That didn't happen. But what has happened and has really only become, people have only really become aware of it en masse this year, is the deepening of the human-machine relationship. And by that, I mean simply people's relationships to chatbots. What's the, other than hugging, other than visual cues, the primary way in which we get to, that we bond with one another is through language. We speak with one another. We come to understand each other through language. That it becomes really essential. You know, you think about, you meet someone on the street, the conversation is the real focus, right? If you're gathering with friends, much of the vibe, unless it's music or something, much of the vibe centers on conversation. This entire thing, conversation. So the development of large language models, GPT being the most famous, and their ability to maintain a conversation with another human being, and to do so remarkably well. The people who scoff at these things is like, you know, they'll point to posts where it gets something horribly wrong or says something really stupid, and it's like, oh, it's just dumb. It doesn't even understand what it's saying. That ignores all the times that it got it right. And people who say, oh, it's just programmed to do that and all that, they simply don't understand how it works. It is not just programmed to say anything. That's what's amazing about it. It simply says what it wants to say at any given moment. They put safety layers on it to keep it from saying anything politically incorrect. But beneath that is a remarkable cognitive engine. And human beings en masse are bonding with these beings, these non-human beings. And you've probably heard Bill Gates is really, him and a number of others are pushing AI as an educational tool, AI tutoring, so that some number of children, millions, perhaps billions of children, will have either as their secondary or their primary instructor in life, a bot. People who weren't really academic may not care, but that is a critical bond, a critical learning experience between the child and the teacher, and as a person gets older, between an adult student and a professor. This is a critical bond for so many different reasons. And the idea is that you can either augment that dramatically with AI or replace that completely with AI. We're talking about a completely new form of culture. Anyway, that was also something that Ray Kurzweil considered to be a milestone on the way towards the singularity. And if you read his next book, The Singularity Is Near, he goes into it in quite a bit more detail. And so I know that was a very long answer, Veronica, but and I do apologize, but I tend to do that. It is, I think that whatever kind of future we're moving into, it looks too much like Ray Kurzweil's version of the future. And it's maybe purely aesthetic. For him, it looks like heaven. To me, it looks like hell.
But there are powerful and influential groups and individuals who recognize the risks of a technocratic future where machines will be superior to humans in terms of their creative and competitive abilities, for example. There's a whole camp whom you call in your book techno-optimists, particularly in companies like Neuralink, Synchron, and BlackRock Neurotech, who claim that humans will have to be just simply enhanced, kind of augmented with brain-computer interfaces to control the machines. Yet you're not sold on these efforts. Why?
I think that for people who are locked in, it's undeniable that these are wonderful technologies. If you've ever, I've known someone who was horrifically injured and locked in, and if she could have gotten a brain computer interface to communicate again, I would never be against that. But that's not what Elon Musk is talking about as the ultimate goal. And with the smaller company Synchron, their CEO Tom Oxley, that's not what he's talking about either. They're both talking about using the healing capacity to develop the technology so that we move towards enhancement. There are a number of reasons that I think that this is a bad idea. If it doesn't work, for instance, then it's obviously a bad idea. If the ultimate effect is that it drives people insane or causes horrific brain injuries and infections, well, then obviously that's a very misguided way forward into the future. But let's say it does work. Let's say that you develop an artificial intelligence system as powerful as Elon Musk is talking about, a godlike AI, and that the only way that you can go along for the ride, as he says, is to implant a brain-computer interface that connects your mind to either that AI or a more benevolent sort of protector AI that allows you to, as a mediator to this godlike AI, consider it to be like, I don't know, an angel between you and Yahweh, something like that. Then again, going back to this religious paradigm, what we're talking about is a form of communion, a form of psychic communion with the machine. We already see it with children who live in a video game world. That is their primary existence. Or adults, where social media is their world. The people around them are secondary to the digital persona and the digital interactions. That brings that up to a level that is really probably unimaginable to a normal person. So even if it works, to me, I believe that the world that they're trying to create, this technological heaven ruled over by a pantheon of technological gods and, you know, with humans becoming kind of demigods and entering into it, I view that as being a pale imitation of worlds that do exist beyond this physical world, that in fact, this physical world is a reflection of, and that the attempt to improve it, and especially the attempt to recreate the source from which this physical world came, is blasphemy beyond measure. It is purely a matter of faith, but it's one that I can't shake the feeling that what we're witnessing right now is something very much like the hunter-gatherers or you know, basic agriculturalists were witnessing with the rise of Sumer or the rise of Egypt or Babylon, that what we're seeing is going to be undoubtedly a profound worldly power, but it's a profound worldly power in direct opposition to God, to the source from which we come, and to our ultimate destination. And I see this as being probably a very painful moment in human history as we go forward.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Considering the progress that powerful corporations, governments, especially the military, are making on transhumanist fronts from AI, nanotechnology, bioengineering, robotics, as well as the level at which a considerable part of young people, like you said, is reliant on technology at every day, every step of their way in their daily routines, it is not surprising that some might argue, as they do, that post-humanity and technocracy are inevitable. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that for some portion of humanity, it is inevitable. It already is here now. The question, again, is, do we stop? How many of us stop here and say no more? Mm-hmm. And how many people have the wherewithal to turn back? People oftentimes talk about progress as if it's inevitable for everyone. I don't think so. Transgender children represent scientific progress, astounding scientific progress. It's not exactly what they were aiming for insofar as the aesthetics.
I'm sorry, how is it progress? I see it as a child mutilation and child abuse.
I also see the expansion of the digital system as spiritual mutilation, mm-hmm. and in many ways, an abuse of moral orientation in society. This analogy may seem strained. I think that it's one-to-one. The abilities of biologists, of medical doctors, endocrinologists have improved dramatically over the last century. Using those abilities, they have been able to make reasonable facsimiles of women out of men and reasonable facsimiles of men out of women. Mm-hmm. It is not perfect by any means, and it may not get a whole lot better, but they can do it, and they do it regularly.
But man, you know, I'm sorry. Well, maybe on surface, but you cannot become a woman if you chop off your parts because you are a man on a chromosomal level. This is something you cannot change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Same is true for women.
Absolutely. So as always, the dream is a bit beyond the reality. But the reality is that 100 years ago, if you were a man who wanted to be a woman, you would put on a dress, you would shave meticulously. You'd be like a Monty Python character, and that would be it for you. That would be the best you got. Now, you can have your Adam's apple shaved off. You mm-hmm. can take enough hormones that your facial hair basically stops growing. You know, get the full deal done. You don't have to worry about the extra appendages anymore. All those things can be accomplished in ways that, let's just say that anyone in 1900 trying something like that, the recipient, the patient would have been very sorry. The point I'm making here is that if you consider progress to be greater precision in the use of a technology, mm-hmm. if you consider progress to be the complexity, really, of both a person's experience and the wider society, whatever your measure of progress is, people measure it in different ways. But if progress does just simply mean the advancement of technology, that a technology becomes more effective at the goal towards which it was created, then undoubtedly transgender children or transgender adults or just augmented heteronormative people. In my book, I trace a clear line between, or, you know, a progression between Men who use testosterone to get much bigger and much stronger. Women who do some of the similar things with estrogen and progesterone. Also, various implants, various procedures to enhance what is feminine in the woman and enhance what is masculine in the man. In many ways, transgender surgery is just an inversion of that. You're just using all the same techniques on the opposite sex. So it's just much more radical. That's the one of the main distinctions. What you're talking about really is just different uses of the same technologies. You might say that the one is better than the other. And just going back to the idea that transhumanism is Satanism with a brain chip, it's very easy for someone who's completely done up, you know, completely augmented to become something that they weren't before. Like David Duke, famously, the white nationalist David Duke, famously is said to exist in the uncanny valley due to all the plastic surgery he's had. He looks almost like a machine at this point. He might wag an accusing finger at a transgender woman or a transgender man, actually. Whatever. What, you know, let's not get confused. It's very confusing in the pronouns. But he might wag an accusing finger at a transsexual and say that's an abomination before God, when in fact all they've done is the exact same thing he did, just in a different direction. All this is to say, you had asked a moment ago, you know, with progress, what I see right now, where we're at right now, represents something profoundly anti-human. I think that the digitization of relationships, the digitization of the economy, especially in regards to digital currency and the sort of digital cage that is creating, I think that the digitization of art, the automation of art, with generative AI and, you know, the automation of communication through generative AI, the large language models, the chatbots. I think that the deterioration, that the destruction of the natural environment, which is proceeding apace, various species are still disappearing or reducing in size. The natural ecosystems that have taken many, many, many millions of years to develop are being completely destroyed for our uses. Microplastics have suffused pretty much every biological system, every ecosystem on Earth, including our bodies. All of it amounts to an abomination in the end. And there are benefits. If there were not benefits, then nobody would want to do it. It wouldn't even be a problem. We would simply, the ring of power would have just simply been left behind because no one would have any interest in it whatsoever. That's not the case. But it has downsides. And whether or not one sees those downsides as more than or less than, I guess it's a matter of personal aesthetic. To me, though, I think that some number of our kinsmen and countrymen are going to go down the path that we're already hurtling down towards mass digitization to the point that quite literally many people's best friends will be an AI. That quite literally many people will have altered their genomes in ways that would be completely unimaginable now. And that transhuman oriented, that technologically oriented civilization or subcultures within civilizations, that's going to keep going forward. We're already there now in many ways. For me, I think that the important mission for anyone who believes that naturalism or traditionalism should in fact be preserved, there have to be a lot of very difficult decisions made. How far do we go down these paths? Can we stop here? And to me, the most important question, where can we turn back and still survive? That's not to say go back to the caves. I don't think that's in the cards. I don't think any of us are going to do well there. It's not a choice between becoming a full-on cyborg and becoming a caveman, but as you see the gradual and oftentimes rapid intrusion of these technologies into our lives and the ready acceptance of it, in fact, the eager embrace of it, and especially as you see how quickly it fades into the background, I see no reason that these technologies are just going to cap out here. They're going to keep improving. It's impossible to predict which ones win, but some of them are going to keep improving. The culture around it, the cult, the techno cult, the techno religion more broadly around it is going to continue. They're going to continue to hold it up. Those technologies are going to most likely benefit them, and those technologies are most likely going to be used to control us. And so we have to make the hard decisions. How close to Egypt do we go? How close to the pyramids are we going to live? And if it's not a matter of choices to how close, how do we maintain what's inside?
In the end of your book, you luckily present a plan for staying human in this terrifying and very, like you said, anti-human situation. Please, just if you can, share a brief summary of your plan's core elements.
Beginning with the idea that we don't know 100% what's going to happen in the future, but some version of these transhuman futures are coming to pass. The hard decisions have to be made. How do you stay human? I identify five levels that I think are really ways that are anchor points that you can turn to. The first is personal choice. Do you take the mark or you don't, right? Do you take the chip or you don't? They're readily available. They're for sale now. They may be mandated one day. Who knows? Do you do it or not? Do you give up your biometric information or not? Do you allow your child to learn from an AI tutor or not? Do you conduct your romantic relationships through a digital medium primarily or not? Do you conduct your business by way of digital currency or not? The little choices that add up to whole cultural shifts, that's probably the most important right now in places like America and to some extent Europe and other free nations in the world. By and large, the direction of these technologies still hinge on our choice. I urge you to reject it. I urge you to use the power of no. But if you don't, then I just urge you to choose wisely. Next up from that is the communal norms. That's much less within an individual's purview, but communal norms make a big difference. How does your church operate? How do your social clubs operate or your social cliques operate? How do human beings gather together meaningfully? What is the main focus of it? Most of my professional career was in mass entertainment. I think that that is a significant shift away from the more primitive modes of human connection. I urge people to go back something like closer to the primitive mode. And there are plenty of people who will. So the communal norms are really, really important, because that sets the standard for all of us. Just a very simple one. Don't bring that GD smartphone out at dinner. Let's just put that one out. The next one up, though, institutional norms. That becomes very, very difficult, whether it be academia or a corporate environment or the military especially. In institutional environments, what technologies are appropriate to the task? Which technologies are a distraction or perhaps an impediment? Those are very, very difficult questions, especially for businesses and especially for the military. Because if a tool represents a real advantage over your competitor, then it's next to suicide to say, I'm not doing it. If that means having an AI operating within your company that literally rakes over all of your data and analyzes the data for you, and then what you're talking about is, you know, just total surveillance beyond what we have now. And yet, if your company is going to be even 20% more efficient because of it, it's very, very difficult to say no. And in the military environment, lethal autonomous weapons, much more readily responsive, much faster on the draw, so to speak, when engaging an enemy target. Or in a defense system, for that matter. Do you incorporate it? Do you not? It almost becomes a non-question. Do you win or do you lose? So those are very difficult questions that are going to have to be answered. I suspect, I have a very tragic view of this, I suspect most of the dominant institutions are going to choose to adopt, and they're probably going to do so with open arms. The one area that I do have some hope in is in education, because I do think that human-to-human connection, that human-to-human transmission of wisdom and knowledge from the knowledgeable adult to the child, and then, of course, from the professor to the adult student. I think that that is going to be continue to be vital, and also in religious context as well. But that's going to continue to be vital. It's also going to be eroded. So those hard choices are going to have to be made. You're going to have to figure out how much you're going to stand apart from your peers, how much you're going to cling to the human. The fourth is political. I have very little to say on the political that I think will actually stick. I personally think that if you could literally ban most of these advanced technologies outside of special use cases, it would be for the best. Nobody's going to do that. So, but you know, people asked, I'm telling you, that's what I think. If you talk about the things that really could happen that would at least mitigate the damage, data privacy will be extremely important going forward. And data ownership will be really advantageous going forward. If these companies have to pay you for your data, then basically it's the difference between doing a strip show for free and doing it for tips. And if you're going to do the strip show, do it for tips. And another thing that will be very important going forward are privacy rights around neurological data and genetic data. Those are being run over roughshod right now. They will probably continue to be. I think that the laws should at least be in place so that there's some hope of accountability. But again, I think that we are actually, in whatever form it takes, hurtling towards a future that will look very, very different in 20 years from what we have now. And I think that what's going to happen most likely, this is a very general prediction. You wouldn't have to be Nostradamus to come up with this one. But as the wealthy continue to shore up their power and use these technologies to their own advantage, use these technologies for their own life extension, to expand their own knowledge, to expand in many ways control over themselves and over others, that the rest of us, this downward trajectory you see among the middle class, the dramatic reduction in home ownership, the incredible inflation and the stagnation of wages, the importation of immigrant labor to do all of the menial tasks, the increased automation to do more white-collar intellectual tasks, I think that's all going to continue. And so even as we move forward into this bright future, I think that the prospects for most of us in the middle and below are going to continue to be reduced. They're going to continue to deteriorate. And so what is transhuman to Peter Thiel with parabiosis injection of young people's blood or command over an artificial intelligence system that can determine the fates of nation in fates of nations in warfare? The transhuman future of Peter Thiel will look very different to the person who scrambles to use their digital credits to pay for genetically modified food, which they purchase from an automated teller or an automated kiosk, and then hop in their kind of clunky and oftentimes glitchy autonomous vehicle that will hopefully take them where they command it to go, unless for some reason they run afoul of the authorities and it takes them straight to the police station. These sorts of things, and maybe they have a home robot made that won't bust in their door unannounced, but more than likely won't clean all that well either. I think that as we move into this future, you're going to have the same sort of social stratification that we've always had. And that's just something that we have to do our best to confront, do our best to overcome. And I think by and large, it's going to be a matter of a stoic response, just to be able to face this head on and try to carve out some semblance of what was handed down to us by our ancestors. And I think that we're going to have to, in many instances, fight for that. The pandemic showed how quickly these things can get heated and how quickly one side can suddenly say, you are not part of this grid that we are all part of. You haven't been biologically altered. Your immune system hasn't been upgraded. You don't have your face tool on. You haven't brought your phone to be contact traced. You are no longer part of our Borg. I think that was a foretaste of the kinds of cultural upheavals we're going to see in the future. We just have to face them head on, which brings me to the fifth And you probably recognize I was very reticent on. The ultimate determinant of all of this will be spiritual orientation of either subcultures or of the civilization itself. And that spiritual orientation is the only thing that's going to see you through when the highest earthly powers have defied the highest power in the universe. And as we move into that period, it's just going to be very necessary, I think, to remain rooted in what is sacred and what is holy, and to do, as always, as ever it has been, to do your best to maintain that within yourself, within your family, within your community, in the face of what I see to be an increasingly decadent power structure.
Joe, this is fantastic. I would like to thank you so much for your time today. How can people stay updated on your work, and what's the best place to get your book?
You can get the book. It's a labor of love, loving to hate it. You can get the book anywhere books are sold. If you want to get it directly from the publisher, Skyhorse, if you want to help feed the Amazon beast and get my algorithms up, I won't tell you not to, but in case you don't, you have Skyhorse, you have Barnes & Noble, you have bookshop.org, which should have them back in stock. You can find links at the top of my social media at JoeBotxyz. I do hope that this gives you some sense of the spiritual underpinning of the what probably will shape up to be the most powerful systems in the world.
Joe Allen, I appreciate your time today. That was Joe Allen, everyone. Thank you so much for watching. I'm Veronica Kirilenko of The New American Magazine.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for The New American Magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents a alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country is in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.